The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, Disc 8.
Tsukina arrived quite promptly, never one to dismiss a summons from her mistress. I sat her down and spoke quite plainly of the arrangements I had made to secure her release from jail and torture. I informed her of my discovering of John's viewing hallway, and how I believed he watched every woman in this house from similar vantage points. I had no doubt whatsoever that he'd visited Tsukina in this regard for several years now. "You ask me to do this thing for you, ma'am. You know I do." "You loathe him. I know, sweet friend. He bad man, miss. Not bad in soul, but bad in action. Bad for the children. Bad for you, Miss Ellen." "We must do this thing," I bid her. "We must grant him this whenever he asks. And he has asked for tonight to help rid him of the haunting that results from the loss of sweet April. You ask me do this. I do this." I kissed her on the lips, long and tenderly. I had hoped nothing might ever spoil our privacy, dear friend. Her eyes burned into mine, and I felt her displeasure with me. Perhaps she would rather have died in jail than take to bed with my husband. I don't blame her for this. "This one night, he never forget," she said. "Tsukina make sure of that." "It's a night none of us shall forget," I said. "Oh, no," she contradicted. "Me, ma'am, I forget this before I return to my own room." And she smiled. When Tsukina smiled, missing teeth and all, the whole room grew brighter. She slipped out of her robe and nightdress and stood before me naked, a powerful and wildly attractive female form. "Take off the nightie, miss." She stepped forward and helped me out of my nightgown. "You say he coming," she said. "Then we give him an eyeful." With that, she took my hand and led me toward my bed.
Editor's note. As arbiter of these entries, after much discussion with my publisher, it was decided that the specific references, April 1st, 1917, were far too graphic and disturbing to be printed here, where readers more interested in the history of Rose Red should not be made to be burdened with the personal exploits and exploitation of the author. We have, as a concession, made this and a few other excerpts available on the World Wide Web at the following address, www.beaumontuniversity.net. Users familiar with the web will note there is no link to these excerpts from any of the web-published pages. You must therefore type in the URL given here, exactly as it is written, in order to reach this private library of Ellen's most personal moments. A further warning. Some of the content therein is explicitly sexual and is not intended for persons under the age of 18. In point of fact, Ellen Rimbauer apparently became obsessed with recounting her nearly nightly bedroom activities over the next several months, writing almost exclusively about her husband's increased addiction to these events and the elaborate acts he conceived for both his wife and his wife's best friend and servant. There are virtually no entries other than these, often repugnant and degrading, until early in 1918, an editorial time jump I readily make in order to spare you, the reader, the sordid descriptions of the debauchery to which John Rimbauer stooped. The only element you lose because of my red pencil is the growing frustration on the part of Ellen and Tsukina at being used in this way, to have what was once a pure love between them corrupted and poisoned by a man who could no longer find any satisfaction in life. Even physical pleasure now robbed him of any victory over the senses. He was consumed in grief. He felt himself a failure, and the deeper he sank, the more bizarre his requests, the more desperate the two women become. There is even an account of a late night spent in the barn. By the time we join back up with Ellen in the pages to come, there have been hints of a conspiracy first forming and then growing between the mistress of the house and her maid. Ellen will not allow the specifics of this conspiracy to reach her pages, for fear of her diary's discovery. But it is quite evident that John Rimbauer is the target, and that plans have already formed to set into motion John Rimbauer's demise. Joyce Reardon.
March 9th, 1918. Rose Red. To look back at the entries herein, it is quite obvious to me how nothing has affected me quite so much as the late night encounters with John and the disturbing nature of his demands upon the women of this house. The events of this day finally are cause for reflection on the larger nature of the problems with Rose Red and her apparent need of fuel, both in terms of her physical expansion, her continued construction, and whatever spiritual needs she has. Today, she killed again. The coroner will put the death of George Meader down as an allergic reaction to a bee sting. But that bee sting came inside the health room.
Editor's note. Health room. Ellen's term for the solarium. Post-1917.
And that room did burst with color upon his death, the same way it exploded with color on the tragic night of April's disappearance and Sukina's confrontation with the policeman there. Meader, a railroad executive who has stayed the week with us, was a big drinker and clearly a womanizer. He flirted with many of the staff and may have had relations with more than one. It was the attention he paid poor Sukina that may have led to his untimely demise. More than once he cornered her, for she tells me everything that happens in this house. More than once he attempted to grope her. Who knows if John had a part in any of this? I cannot see John sharing stories of our alliance, our triad, but I put little past the man. For her part, Sukina finally arranged for George to meet her in the health room at the stroke of midnight. George appeared, quite drunk, but on time. Alerted to Sukina's plans, I kept watch of the health room from above, alert to any lights coming on in various hallways or the kitchen. If I saw any such activity, I was to switch the lights of my room repeatedly. Sukina would be able to see my chamber's windows from inside the health room. All went according to plan. George showed up in the health room, and Sukina immediately began dancing in a most fluid, provocative, and suggestive manner. Even distanced as I was, I felt the power of that dance. No man could fail to respond to those hips, the loose-jointed nature of her body as it expressed itself. I could see George Meader reach for his collar, for the health room is considerably warmer than the rest of the house, even without Sukina dancing, and attempt to unbutton it. He slipped off his coat, perhaps at Sukina's instruction. Only moments after he had removed his coat, Sukina sank to the floor, her legs crossed, and apparently set her mind to prayer, or whatever it is she does exactly. Barely seconds passed before I saw George Meader swat his arm. The bee had stung him. Summoned, I remain convinced, by Sukina's substantial meditative powers. Sukina waited only briefly for George to sink to his knees. Then she slipped quietly into the garden and through the pool house, returned by the south stairs to her rooms. Meader died without so much as a sound. Upon his death, the first blooms of red roses appeared, vines wandering and growing and extending themselves before my eyes. Within minutes, I could no longer see inside the health room, overgrown as it was by the wandering vines. Nothing was found of George Meter for several hours, except that coat he had removed. Only the next day, as the vines impossibly receded and returned to their previous state, was the body found. The flesh was torn by thorns as if he'd been rolled in a bed of roses. John instructed the stable boys to cart the body downtown, knowing I would refuse the police entrance into my home for anything but outright murder, and even then, only with the proper documents. Was it Rose or Sukina who took George Meter from this world? Does it matter any longer? I feel half crazy with it all. More than half, if you believe the staff. I have nearly abandoned my own suspicions of the Indian burial ground, and yet Indian artifacts continue to surface in the house, and one, an earthen ceramic bowl shaped as a beehive, did find its way into the health room, as I recall. Perhaps the mysteries of this place will never be solved. Perhaps some scientist will come along in future generations to explain what I, sadly, cannot. Who's to tell? One thing is for certain. I will continue to build Rose Red until the day I die, or until I myself am claimed, even with my own hands when necessary. As I continue to construct the tower, I will continue to attempt to negotiate a longer life for myself that I might outlive my husband. This I pray for more than anything, that I might find my child still alive. Adam is barely a part of my life, as John will not allow him to return to this place. I know my son only through letters, and these letters are less frequent each year. Another has died. I barely mourn the loss. Rose Red has her needs. Sukina and I must protect ourselves. Arthritis has found my fingers. I'm in excruciating pain, and I fear my entries here in your pages, dear diary, shall be fewer and farther between. What more is to be said? I live in a world condemned. Made into someone I am not by night, in my husband's desperate attempts to find satisfaction, reduced to prayer and silence by day. Sneaking off to build with my hands what this house demands of me. The tower, she whispers at night, my little April. Soon, our reunion, as I have ordered the exterior of the tower to be built, my stairway nearing completion. A year or two at most, I'm told, following on the heels of projects already planned. A golden cherub has been ordered, cast in Italy by artisans in Florence. This cherub will stand high atop Rose Red and lord over our property. Perhaps over Rose Red herself. Plans are taking shape. My daughter is coming home.
Editor's note. Although the subsequent lack of diary entries is attributed to Ellen Rimbauer's arthritis, there is some evidence that this period proved traumatic to her and that she suffered at least one breakdown. With the doctor's recommendation, she attend a clinic, see November 16, 1921, in Switzerland. Ellen Rimbauer refused to leave Rose Red and her beloved Sukina. Recently recovered documents, the diary of Tina Coleman, for one, promote the idea that John was behind Ellen's illness and that Switzerland was his attempt to remove her from Rose Red once and for all. This plan failed, regardless of its source. On the 17th of October, 1920, a serious fire claimed an entire wing of Rose Red. The cause of that fire has never been named. It must be considered as a possibility that Ellen set that fire herself in protest to John's attempts to be rid of her. A study of the contractor's notes and plans show no work on the tower scheduled for nearly 20 months. Another theory behind the fire and all their relationship problems was that Ellen found out John was purposely delaying work on the tower. Regardless of disagreements, construction on the tower began in earnest in early November 1920. To this day, three important questions remain surrounding the period 1918 to 1920. 1. Ellen's mental state. 2. The activity of the house. For example, there are reports of nearly a dozen disappearances in this 24-month period. And 3. John's growing fear of his wife, his wife's maid, Sukina, and the house that together the Rimbauers continued to build and remodel at an alarming pace. There are writings, though no substantial evidence, that suggest it was John, not Ellen, who had lost touch with reality, and that during this time he became badly addicted to laudanum, spending days at a time in the opium dens south of the city and away from the monstrosity of a house he had come to fear. Joyce Reardon.
June 19th, 1921, rose red. Sparks. I see robins outside my window. Twiddly, twiddle-dum. I smell smoke in the auditorium. Where have I been? I ask myself, looking back at your pages. Is it possible I have not written my thoughts down here, except once in a blue moon? I feel as if I write here every day, but perhaps that is just my imaginings. I have been overcome with fever quite regularly. In truth, these fevers always seem to follow my nights spent in the company of my husband. A pleasant way to write down here what is not often pleasant at all. For several years now he has included Sukina in our participation. I'd rather not say. Twiddly, twiddledum, sparks. The servants are out testing explosives for our annual 4th of July party. I watch from my window, singing songs I recall from my childhood. How can childhood seem so far away? A part of another person's life, surely not mine. Sparks. Boom, boom, boom. If once I held any innocence, it has burned away like the gunpowder in these displays I watch. No innocence in the bedroom. No innocence at the window. At least not the night I helped Sukina wrap George Meter in thorny vines. No innocence inside my head, where I spend an increasing amount of time trying to foresee my husband's maneuvers to remove me from this place. I've hidden from him, up in the attic, still working on the stairs to the tower, for days at a time. John wandering the house, calling out, perhaps secretly hoping Rose has claimed me once and for all. Me, waiting. Waiting. Letting him wet his whistle on this notion. Letting his heart beat with excitement at the possibility I'm gone forever. And then I waltz into the breakfast room, as if not away from him for more than a few minutes. I watch his face sag. I smile enormously and greet him with bright, rested eyes and good humor. Later, he stews. Angry. Alone. I like him that way, angry and alone. I want him to pay for all the innocence he has taken from me, from us. I talk to Rose openly now, no longer afraid. I tell her I want to see my daughter. I offer myself to her walls, but she asks strange things of me. We have remodeled an upstairs hall to become the perspective hallway. It diminishes in the same fashion as train tracks, one end to the other. It's in honor of the late George Meter and his rail company. But this is a hall, and the deeper you enter it, the lower the ceiling, the tighter the walls. It is not unlike my life itself. The longer I have lived, the more confined I feel by my surroundings. At 34, I feel more like 80 years of age. I have hidden doors off the perspective hallway, in the same manner my husband has hidden his viewing rooms throughout this palace. Some go nowhere. Others lead to mazes of hallways. In one such secreted hallway, I hung a great nude on the other side of glass, just to annoy my husband should he stray inside. Life imitates art, they say. Or is it the other way around? Today marks the grand opening of the tower. Our friends, I hear tell, are referring to my endeavor as the Tower Folly. Be that as it may, I'm quite proud of the addition. It includes the stairs that lead from the attic to a single room of generous proportions, offering a full panoramic view of all of Rose's wings, our property and its forests, as well as the commanding sight of the city and Elliott Bay beyond. It is the most beautiful, most important addition to our grand home, and is certain to take its place as one of my favorite spots. Now that it is open, complete with the lovely Venetian glass window and the 24-carat gold-plated Italian cherub that adorns the peak of its roof, I feel as if I have a retreat of sorts, a place to hide, a place to pray, a place to seek my missing daughter. John has not been in favor of the tower. He fears I put too much faith in the tower helping me to locate April, and I admit here that he is quite right about that. My faith, that is. But our beliefs differ so greatly that John also trusts that there is little or no hope of any such physical structure providing a conduit, a medium that might reconnect us with our missing April. A fallacy in him I strive to correct. My mind wanders so frequently now, led as I am in so many directions. My wanderings come with more frequency and last longer. I see the staff steer clear of me in the hallways, shaken by my pale face, no doubt, or my unsteady walk. They have never lost a child as I have. They have never compromised their existence as I have, obeying my husband and tolerating untold embarrassments in order to remain in the house of my child's disappearance. To leave John would certainly mean leaving Rose, and that is even more unthinkable now than it was before. Sukina and I have agreed to meet at midnight, providing John does not call for our services, and with the completion of the tower, attempt to summon sweet April. We will climb and listen for the winds that have instructed me for these past several years, my hands bloodied with my efforts as a carpenter. It seems to me I shall always be putting finishing touches on my attic stairway, which ascends through three turns to the tower. It will never be perfect, will always require attention, but so does a child, of course. This tower is my child, just as my child is this tower. How could I ever neglect it for even a single day? But alas, I am late for my rendezvous with my maid. Sukina and I meet in the upstairs hallway, alongside the panel that I had discovered previously, and let ourselves in. I carry a battery-powered flashlight, heavy as it is, and lead the way along the now familiar route, past the guests' quarters, up and into the attic. We stand at the base of my stairs, where the early work of my carpentry is seen for what it is, crude and poorly done. Through the door, the bottom stair is crooked, as are the next three, those in lessening proportions. The wood is still raw and untreated, as I have much work yet to do, and will not allow any of the workers to touch a thing here. We climb slowly, to cries and complaints of the poorly assembled stairs, and I shine the light on Tsukina as she lags behind. Even she appears frightened. I take this as a good sign and encourage her on. I certainly must look a bit ghostly myself, drained of color as I am of late, standing there in my sheer nightgown, the yellow light flashing around unsteadily as I wave the flashlight unintentionally in my right hand, directing her. Perhaps Tsukina is more afraid of me than this tower. I shouldn't be surprised. Everyone else seems to fear me and my condition. Now, as we approach the second turn, I finally hear what it is that has frightened my dear friend, what she has heard that I did not. The creaking of the stairs no longer sounds like lumber rubbing on lumber, nails straining against nails. Increasingly, it sounds like a voice, a familiar voice, a child's voice. April! The higher we climb, the more the creaking goes to wind, the wind to voice. Mama! It calls, and I hurry my ascent, climbing all the faster. Tsukina, protective perhaps, is nearly running to keep up with me. Miss Ellen, she calls, the condition of warning carried in her tone. It is as if she fears that the door at the very top of these stairs, a door that grows larger by the moment, will lead not to the panoramic view I anticipate, but to some dark, foreboding place where young April is kept hidden, and those who enter along with it. Alas, as I burst through the upper door and out into the brisk night chill, the tower is not heated, I am bathed in colorful light. For a moment, I feel as if I'm in the light of God, and I wonder if, indeed, Rose Red has not claimed me and is in the process of transporting me to wherever April lives. I always think of April as alive, but in another place. My motherly ways will allow no other consideration. Then I see Tsukina circling the tower in front of me. It is the moon and the stained glass window that have poured this light across me. April! I call out, the wind rushing up the stairs below and encompassing me. Mama! Mama! I feel dizzy. My child is so very close. I can smell her, taste her sweet cheeks as I kiss away her tears. I fall to my knees, trembling. I am pointing. Tsukina misunderstands, believing I am pointing to her. Then she slowly looks around behind her in the same direction as my finger is aimed. She too falls down onto her knees. She lowers her head and kisses the boards we kneel upon, the floor to the tower. The temple, I shall think of it from now on. I ordered that stained glass window of the rose more than a decade earlier, while on my honeymoon with my husband, before the birth of Adam, before the birth of April. And yet here, backlit by the full moon as it is, the sound of my daughter's voice swirling through the rotunda, so clear and crisp and young. This multicolored window does not depict a rose at all. The tones and patterns have shifted in this shimmering light, the moon playing tricks on the eyes, or so some would say. Instead of a rose in that window, It is a face that Tsukina and I now see. As clear and as apparent as if I'd instructed the artisans to fashion it in this regard so many years ago. But how could they have? She wasn't born yet. For you see, dear diary, the image in that lovely window is not a rose at all, but a portrait. It is the face of my child, April, just as she looked the day she disappeared. As the wind blows eerily in our ears, her lips move, and she talks to me. November 16th, 1921. I return to your pages after too long an absence. John's proclivity toward moodiness has increased with each month. He seems tired so much of the time. He returns from the city late, late at night, with odd smells on his clothing. The closest I have come to experiencing these same odors was while visiting Madame Lou. His husbandly appetites have subsided. He has not visited my chambers in nearly 3 months. I cannot speak of my fears on these pages, but I imagine the worst for poor John. While his fortune continued to grow, his partnership dissolved, a good friend had an unfortunate accident in his health room, his daughter disappeared, and his home began building itself without him. A protracted battle erupted between John and our contractor when the contractor accused my husband of shopping out work to a moonlighting crew, for a great deal of carpentry work is often accomplished overnight within the walls of Rose Red. No explanation has been given, but the contractor has been replaced by one who asks no such questions. In the midst of his depression, what the doctors are calling it, John has twice tried to force me to travel to Switzerland, once this summer, and again in late September, to attend a health clinic where he hoped I might find peace from my affliction with fever. Reunited with my daughter, as I am in my late-night visits, wisely I have told John nothing of this, I refuse to budge. Nothing can take me from Rose Red now. Tsukina believes this was the intention of the house all along. Perhaps a bit jealous herself, my maid believes this rambling palace is somehow in love with me and wants me all to herself. The reason for this entry in your pages, the cause of my alarm, is that today John issued an ultimatum that I was not to visit the tower any longer. He ordered it boarded up and padlocked. Although I long to understand his reasoning, does he sense a change in me? I cannot, of course, allow him to make such impossible demands. I wonder if John himself did not stray up to that lofty place late one night and see the face, hear the voice himself. Perhaps it proved too much for him. Perhaps he snapped and has slid downhill ever since. Perhaps only now can he begin to come to grips with what happens in that magic place and strive to prevent me from experiencing it myself. I have never understood John Rimbauer, and I understand him even less now. But we have had a conversation about this demand of his, and for the first time in our marriage, I threaten my husband with his life. I suggested that poison might find its way into his food. A mechanical failure might befall his motor car. A dockside whore might run him through with a knife. The biggest threat of all, I saved for last. I offered to reinvite his recent house guests. We've entertained a series of prominent bankers of late as John negotiates a pipeline deal. And to parade them down the back hallways that afford my husband the opportunity to regard their wives in a full state of undress and while taking their toilet. I dare say the loans would dry up quite quickly. After a brief consideration, John removed his ultimatum. But the look he gave me chilled me to the bone. I fear what little peace still exists in this house is now destined as a part of our past. June 9th, 1922. Rose Red. My husband has taken a turn for the worse. Violence surrounds him, follows him like a shadow. He eats alone, leaves the house early in the morning, and sometimes stays away for days at a time. I am told by those who should know that he has been seen gambling quite heavily in the Chinese district south of the city, that he has lost a considerable amount of money, and that a certain intemperance has left him in need of regular visits to that community, sometimes several times a day. Tonight, he threatened our head waiter with a carving knife, ostensibly because the beef was prepared too rare. I don't see the problem. John is hardly eating at all any longer. He then threw a tureen on the floor, shattering it, and causing the girls who work in the dining room to flee and not return. Our head waiter quit, walked out. We will need to replace him tomorrow. That is, if news of John's temper has not reached everywhere in this city, which I fear has resulted in a protracted difficulty in Mr. Tammerman securing domestics of any quality. Rose Red has turned. She is in a season of decline. I attribute this to John's reduction of the construction budget. He has cut building by half. And whereas our fine home now accommodates over 35,000 square feet of living space, can sleep 42, and feed several hundred in grand style, she could have been more grand, more luxurious, had John not started pinching his pennies. Tonight, Sukina and I spoke of this at length, for even she now acknowledges that we have seen less of April during this time of slow growth. Rose Red must be allowed to expand. The faster the construction, the more visits from my daughter. My husband and I vary greatly in our opinions on this matter. I do not know if my maid suggested it, or if perhaps it was I, but a very clear need exists for the departure of John Rimbauer. He is in my way, in Tsukina's and the staff's way, and is now in the way of the house herself. Something must be done. I fear it is up to me to decide exactly what.
Afterward. My great-grandmother's diary ended here, and were it not for the work of Joyce Reardon's recent expedition into Rose Red, it might have ended here forever. However, I was a part of that expedition, and had the good fortune to discover in the attic a second installment to the diary, hidden in the wall of the tower, ironically, on the other side of a false door, installed behind an old discolored watercolor of a red rose hanging on the wall. I believe great-grandma may have painted that watercolor herself. The entries that follow are disturbing, to say the least. But they do confirm some of what was discovered during the Reardon expedition, the intention of which was to psychically awaken the slumbering beast of Rose Red. As the old sage has said, be careful what you ask for. We know now, through this confirmation, the cause of at least one fatality, and perhaps in the years to follow we shall uncover more. Much of the late diary is written in a code, an encryption that has yet to be broken. My great-grandmother had either unspoken talents or a connection to a place that few, if any, of us will ever access. What follows are excerpts from the second diary. Stephen Rimbauer, Seattle, Washington, September 2000. Joyce Reardon's final editorial was respectfully moved to conclude the diary.
February 19th. 1923. Rose Red. 4 p.m. Winter has proved especially vexing and tiresome. I put into your pages now what never must be revealed to any living person. I have, for this reason, made amendments to my last will and testament, ensuring your destruction, dear diary, should anything happen to me. For the past several months, and more so in recent weeks, Sukina and I have conspired. Yes, I choose my words carefully. On some way to do away with John Rimbauer. Try as I have to drive him from this home in recent months, my efforts have been to no avail, in part because my husband is no longer the man he once was. His trips to the Chinese sector are more a part of his life than anything here. He returns disoriented and confused, and he strikes out in terror at anyone in his way. He has become far more than a nuisance. Last week, when he violently took liberties with Julie, the 15-year-old daughter of Mrs. Crothers, our housemaid, I promised an end to it. This very evening, my maid and I shall deliver on our promise. ...8 p.m. I am told by Sukina that the first part of our devious plan is now in place. She visited my husband in his upstairs office at tea time, a visit she had never made once in all her years in our service, and I'm told the conversation went something like this. To give you the benefit of imagination, dear diary, I should tell you that Sukina's full black form, when clothed loosely in white Egyptian cotton, is so provocative that my husband banned her from this dress early on in her service. I should also add that during the days of John's visits to my chambers with my maid in attendance, he never knew her in the biblical sense. He watched, he leered, but he never knew her. As odd as this may sound, and it does so to me, even here on your pages, I believe this omission of the act has been out of respect to me. And I also believe it has thrown him into internal turmoil that has, these many months, resulted in a string of self-destructive acts. Evening, sir. Sukina. She says he was seated behind his great English partner's desk, a fire burning in the fireplace, a brandy held in hand. His dark blue velvet and black satin smoking jacket, charcoal gray trousers, ascot, cigar, the snifter of brandy. Is there anything you are needing, sir? Sukina is my maid, not his. Surely her approach, this arrival in his private chambers, must have struck him oddly. Such as? Anything at all? I can just imagine her lilting tone, the shifting from one broad hip to the other, the way she does. When Sukina moves, it is like a cheetah. John has always been slightly afraid of the big cats. Anything? Anything, sir, she added. Miss Ellen, she asleep, sir. Took some bourbon with milk not an hour ago. I am prone to finding my sleep quickly when under the influence of spirits. No one is more aware of this than my husband. He looked at her with a cocked head and curious eye. I be wondering, sir, about things. About you? About you and me, sir. A woman can't help but wonder. You've been wondering about... Astonishment. I imagine the laudanum must dull my husband's good senses. He has not shown any such senses in many months. Lull him. Fool him. How else could others trick him into parting with his money so easily? This man who amassed a fortune only to squander it away. I wish, dear diary, I could summon even a modicum of sympathy for my dear John, but reason does not allow me such luxury. except for a brief period of courting, I have known him to be a selfish man. I served a purpose in his life. The same way a railroad tycoon can provide his oil transportation, I offered legitimacy of his offspring. He poisoned my womanhood with his dalliances, made me barren, and robbed me of the one thing I could offer. He takes women like he takes meals, often and hungrily. He lavished no love upon his daughter, and yet offered his son anything he desired, including a way out of this house. With his good looks and winning smile, he has cajoled many a businessman and every woman into surrendering whatever it is they hold dearest, all the while believing John Rimbauer was doing them a favor. The only thing I've ever seen frighten him is this house, my dear Rose. And so it was to Rose I turned in my hour of need. I told you not to wear that clothing around this house, woman. It's not proper.
I be having a problem sleeping, sir, thinking about... Sukina, sorry if my dressing gown does not please you.
Please me?
Yes, sir. He rose slowly out of his chair, the fire crackling.
Please me? He repeated.
It's not something I ever speak to the miss about. You can see that, sir.
Indeed.
Something I got to know. A woman got to know. She paused, then turned for the door. Was thinking about the tower, sir. Put a quilt in the tower, I did. Heavy quilt. The one from Sweden. You know the one. Maybe Sukina take her sleep in the tower.
She left his study then, fully confident that behind the haze of the laudanum and the brandy, the cigar, and that ruddy confidence of his, my husband would follow like a puppy to its mother. Sure enough, he did just that. She walked luxuriously, strolling down the great wide halls of rose red, as if in a processional, my husband trailing a few yards behind. Down the hall, she turned into his own changing room, and this must certainly have shocked him. She walked straight into his closet, opened the secret panel at the back, and entered the narrow hallway that led directly to the attic. By now he must have thought her possessed of black magic, for he never missed a step, ducking through his own clothing and following that path he had followed so many times before. Even then, with lurid thoughts occupying him, I see it in my mind's eye as a spectacle. Sukina in front of him by a few steps, my husband's slightly drunken gait following a few paces behind, his heart racing with anticipation. This cherished prize that has remained out of reach all these years. In our African camp, I got to Sukina before John did, as she was assigned to me as my handmaid. I can only imagine the frustration this caused in him now that I know what was always on my husband's mind. Now that I know it was there in that camp that he exposed himself to sinful disease, I have wondered many times what our lives might be like had I taken to God the way so many women do. Would we now be blessed? Why did I choose to pray to the dark side, make alliances with powers beyond my understanding? God, too, is beyond my understanding, so why not God? How much better this might have all turned out. Forgiveness instead of revenge, faith instead of accusation and hardship. Perhaps now is the time. I hear it is never too late to turn to the Christ. Just think, all that I have imagined, all that I have suffered through, and yet still a chance for salvation. Up my twisting and complaining staircase did they come, Sukina now leading my frightened husband by the hand. The winds began calling behind the creaking of that lumber. Da, 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 da. My husband's blood ran cold, despite the brandy. His eyes grew large with fear. He stopped his ascent, nearly pulling Sukina over, who had the lead. Come, she said.
I can't. Do you hear that?
Hear only the wind, sir, she lied. Mustn't be afraid of the wind.
Is that all it is?
Oh, yes, sir. The tower get all sort of the winds. She reminded him. The quilt, sir, when we to lie down, the wind no longer make the sound. She tugged on his arm. The master not afraid of a little wind. When one needs John to budge, one resorts to his playing against his own impressions of himself. This trick worked. He fluffed himself up, expanded his chest, and took after my maid once again, slowly ascending the misshapen staircase leading to the tower. She threw the door open. It had to be the right night. We knew that in our early stages of planning. First, a full moon, for these are the nights that April will visit. Second, that time of night when the moon sits just above the horizon, fully lighting the stained glass window there. We knew what would be said. The stress of an infirm wife, his daughter disappearing like that, the gambling, the visits to Chinatown, the social pressures that wealth can bring. Sukina entered the tower first. The voice was so clearly April's now. Da, da, it said. John stepped in behind, and the door gently swung shut behind him. In the stained glass window, the lovely rose changed before our eyes into a ghostly specter of my daughter's misshapen and withered arm. The wind asked, "These are your gifts to your children?" My husband stood as if his shoes had been nailed to the flooring. The hand in the window, my daughter's hand, plain as day, beckoned him, her finger waving him toward her. Da, da. Come. Look. If all those years ago in Africa, a person had told me that someday the spirits would join me in the fulfillment of my wishes, I might have imagined pure love between husband and wife, worldly travel, and long, sumptuous meals that added not a pound to my frame. A family of 6 children, songs by the fire in the evenings, and a game of whist with friends after supper. I might never have imagined this. John took one final step closer to the window. He looked to his feet. No quilt. He looked up and saw me hovering behind the door, for it had been me who had shut it, closing him in. The power of 2 women can be formidable, especially when combined with the determination of years of struggle and anger that had steeped inside both Sukina and me. She took an arm and yanked, spinning him. I charged with all my strength. But in the end, it was neither Sukina nor me. I only wish it were so. It was April. That enormous wind that did the job for us. I threw my weight into John, certainly. Sukina pulled with all her substantial strength. A look of shock and surprise, the hunter hunted. My husband lifted off his feet in an ungainly and weightless manner. There, he faced our daughter in the stained glass window. April smiled and blinked and repeated one last time, da, da. At that moment, I wondered Had it been Sukina's and my idea, or had it been April's all along? John Rimbauer planted his feet. He skidded across the wooden planks, and I swear I smelled burning wood as his heels dragged. He flew up and through the window, exploding it into a thousand pieces, and plunged down and off the slate roof from some 50 feet above the flagstone terrace. I recall him insisting upon the construction of that abysmal front terrace. I had never cared for it. I like it a lot better now that it's rose red. February 26th, 1923. My son came home today, and together we buried his father. Hundreds attended, from women whose names I did not want to know, to the dockhands who thought of him as a personal friend, to the bankers, businessmen, and public officials who have made their careers off him. I stood in all black, crying real tears, holding my son firmly by the shoulder, the first time I have seen him in nearly 3 years. It is difficult to express in these pages the acute sense of loss, of grief that I am experiencing. Despite all the atrocious things John Rimbauer did to me, the pain he brought to my life, I admired him greatly, loved him at times, and marveled at his success. Even with the gambling losses, he leaves behind a dynasty, a king's fortune, as it turns out. Adam and I spent the later part of the afternoon walking the woods where he and his father hunted squirrels and rabbit. After some reminiscing and retelling of stories about his father, Adam finally brought up the subject he had avoided for years. "Is it haunted?" he asked, looking not at me, but at his own boots in the wet leaves. "It's possessed," I answered honestly. "That's the best way I can put it."
"As in ghosts?"
"Spirits." We stopped on the trail, overlooking Lasky Pond. "And April?" Here was the discussion I had so longed to have with my son. I knew that John had colored his opinion. The newspaper, perhaps at John's bidding, had reported a day or two later that the ice on Lasky Pond was found broken, and that April might have fallen through. I wonder, then, that we never found the body. This became the generally accepted view: an accident on the pond. A bear who had gotten close to the city. A mountain lion. Anything but the truth. "She's in the house, Adam."
"That's preposterous, Mother."
It was my husband's voice, though carried in my son's body, and the effect was disarming. How quickly they learn. "Why do you think your father found ways all these years to keep you from returning to the house? You think he was afraid of the woods? This pond?
He was afraid of the walls."
"Father was afraid of nothing." "We're all afraid of something, dear. Your father was a great man, but he was afraid of the truth. He fired Douglas Posey to avoid facing the truth. He kept you from this house, your home. Never fear the truth, Adam. It's the only real passport you have to reach new levels of understanding. You may find it corny, but the truth can set you free."
"It is corny,"
he towed the fallen leaves, burrowing a wet hole into the forest floor and overturning a small shiny rock. "If you stay long enough, it may be possible for you to hear her voice."
"Mother..."
"What? I'm crazy? You can tell me, Adam. You tell me." March 1st, 1923. So it was that on a perfectly still night, 3 days later, my son and I climbed the creaking tower steps toward that place where his father had met his death. Adam is a good-looking, strong boy of 13, with wide shoulders and thoughtful eyes. Despite his adolescent strength, he moved cautiously and nervously up those stairs, the wind rising in our ears. Wind at first, then the soft calling of his sister's voice. As their mother, I had forgotten how close these two had been, nearly inseparable, until Adam was shuttled off to boarding school. They had grown up nearly as twins, Adam helping his slightly incapacitated sister, April as foil for his games and test subject for his inventions. My young boy, whom this school had developed prematurely into a young man, collapsed down onto the steps and wept openly, falling into his mother's arms and knowing this was no trick. He was afraid, and I should have thought about his tender age and realized it was too soon for him. There would be plenty of time for all this. Why had I insisted on rushing it? Why had I felt nearly desperate to prove my sanity to my child? Is such a thing provable anyway? As it was, mother and son eventually reached the tower, sitting on its wooden floor. The open hole that had been the stained glass window was now boarded up. Someday, I will manage to replace that window. We huddled together, crying, laughing. Adam tried to talk back to that whispering voice, and though I did not understand the exchange, I would swear here on these pages that he spoke with his sister. I know for a fact that he returned to the tower each and every night and spent hours up there. He is back at school now, but he's writing me nearly daily. This son who had been virtually absent from my life. I feel whole again. Woman. Mother. John's absence is more tolerable each passing day. Peace has returned to Rose Red. Adam and I are family again. Nothing so sweet. February 19th. 1928. Dear God in heaven, give her back to me. Sukina has gone missing. Last seen in the health room. No sign of her anywhere. I wander this tomb's endless hallways, wondering why everyone who becomes so close to me ends up stolen from my life. Robbed from me. I hate this house. Despise it. I will never invite Adam back again. The staff is nearly sick with looking for my maid. So many hours, days now, have we been at it. The house is impossibly large. Believe this or not, dear diary, we all have witnessed physical transformations. Hallways change structure and appearance behind your back. Rooms disappear. What is going on? How can it be? A physical structure, a building, and yet fluid as water. A chameleon. She no longer requires growing larger. She reinvents herself internally. Once a hallway, now a ballroom. Once a basement, now a dungeon. I ordered all Sukina's plants uprooted from the health room, for upon her disappearance, it bloomed more richly than I have ever seen, every plant at once in full blossom. I watched that task carried out, watched it with my own eyes from up in my chambers, recalling my past observation of other events down there as well. 7 workers took 3 hours to clear the room down to bare soil. By the time they reached the west end, the east had sprouted new plants. By the following morning, the plants were 6 feet tall, taller than they'd ever been, and in full bloom. That is Sukina providing that bloom. Her love, her energy, her powers. We all, every one of us, heard Rose Red laugh last night. Laugh at me. At us. It was the most frightening sound I've ever heard. If there is a game to this, she has clearly won. They're all gone. My loved ones. I am alone. Alone in my thoughts. Alone in my silence. Alone in this house. I shall fire the entire staff before she gets another of them. I shall dwell in this place alone for a time. Let her suffer. Let her fail. Perhaps then we can strike a bargain, this house and me. Perhaps then she'll allow me to visit Sukina as I do April. My husband taught me well. Everything is negotiable.
Editor's note. Bookkeeping records substantiate Ellen Rimbauer's claim of firing the 34 staff members for a period of 4 months. During that time, it is believed, she lived in Rose Red completely alone and without a single visitor. Whatever her mental state going into this solitude, she came out the worse for wear. Over the subsequent 2 months, she reinstated a staff of 20. She threw parties. At the last, 1946's annual inaugural ball, one of that period's greatest film actresses, Diana Petrie, disappeared in Rose Red. There are unconfirmed rumors that her friendship with Ellen went beyond the norm. This was the last great party thrown in Rose Red. The staff was reduced to 15 at the start of the U.S. involvement in World War II. By 1950, Ellen Rimbauer had disappeared. In 1950, as she was approaching the age of 70, a nearly blind Ellen Rimbauer is said to have entered the prospective hallway, never to return. Staff there claim to have since heard sawing and hammering in the attic. At the time of her death, Ellen Rimbauer, once the most beautiful and envied woman in Seattle's high society, was a wizened old lady, feverish, half-blind, and slightly mad. It is said that from time to time, Rose Red can be heard laughing or crying, that the sound carries for miles and is often mistaken for either a wild animal or a ship's horn. Soon I shall venture inside Rose Red, armed with sophisticated detection equipment. Stephen Rimbauer, a descendant of Ellen and John Rimbauer, and some of the most powerful perceptionists, psychics, in this part of the country. We hope to awaken the soul of this enormous structure, the being that lies within the walls, and to open communication with either April, Sukina, Ellen, or Rose Red herself. It is this last option that I fear most of all. This diary confirms a formidable presence. As always in the study of psychic phenomena, one accepts a certain amount of the unknown, the uncharted. Spin a globe, open a door, and who knows what may happen. We shall see. Life is an adventure. Rose Red offers the research opportunity of a lifetime. Who, in my field, would turn down such an opportunity? And so I go forward, uncertain and yet excited. We cannot discover the psychic boundaries that exist if we don't dare look for them. What we find is ours for a moment, science's forever. It is that moment I cherish, that singular moment when whatever is out there is mine and mine alone. In that winking of an eye, the world is limitless, and I along with it. Joyce Reardon, PPA, MD, PhD. The End. You've been listening to The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, My Life at Rose Red, edited by Joyce Reardon, PhD, narrated by Alexandra Okarma. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Frankenstein by Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.